Hi, everybody. Welcome to All Things Aviation and Aerospace. I'm Vince Mickens with the Private Air Media Group. As most of you know, every week I have guests on from a variety of disciplines in the fields of aviation and aerospace. And yeah, I've seen a number of women over the years in the industry knocking down barriers, breaking through obstacles, and accomplishing some amazing things. But throughout the series of shows that I've been doing during Women's History Month and in acknowledgement of International Women's Day during the month of March, I was kind of blown away. I was like, wow, some serious accomplishments in a variety of areas that I didn't even know women were doing things in this industry outside of the obvious. So I think it's been great. It's observing the diversity of accomplishments and actually being able to be a part of that. So much so that I said, okay, I know Women's History Month ended yesterday, but I'm going to sneak one more show that kind of focuses on women and the accomplishments, particularly in aviation and aerospace. And that brings me to our two guests today, who I'm just honored to have both. Both have had and are having amazing careers, and I think are going to be able to shed a lot of light on a lot of things from their what they do and how they got there to just their determination and persistence to pursue their path of and their goals and that type of thing. So without further ado, I'll start out by introducing Dr. Yolanda Shea. Dr. Shea is a physical research scientist, and she studies and explores things like atmospheric science. She's also a project scientist for the NASA Clario Pathfinder, which is orbiting our Earth and looking at things that are related to climate. I think it's really great because a lot of the conversation, particularly in recent years, has been about climate change and how that's affecting. And Dr. Shea is on the forefront of that with regard to the scientific side of it and things like that. So it'll be interesting to see how she got into it and also what she does. And then all the way from Johannesburg, South Africa, beaming in via Zoom webinar, we have what she describes herself as a social entrepreneur, which I think is very cool. And she's an advocate of girls' education in STEAM. Science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Rafilwe Ledwaba, did I say that right, Rafilwe? Without rolling my R?
You did.
Ledwaba. Rafilwe Ledwaba, besides being the first African woman helicopter pilot flying for the South African police, Rafilwe founded Girls Fly Program, a Girls Fly Program in Africa Foundation, and is the general manager of Drone Safety and Legal, which is a drones training tech startup. Rafilwe, welcome all the way from Johannesburg.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. And I guess I can call you Yolanda. I want to call you Dr. Shea just to give you your props, but welcome to the show as well.
Please do call me Yolanda.
Okay, will do. Now that I have your permission, I will do that. So really great to have both of you on with us today to talk about your careers and to hear your advice to our young viewers and their parents that may be watching with regard to this show. So we were having a really fun discussion prior to coming live on the air. So might as well continue that conversation. And I'm going to start it with you, Rafilwe. You have had quite a journey there in South Africa from early on. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started and how aviation came into the picture?
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Vince, for the invitation. And Dr. Shea, it's an honor to be sharing this platform with you. Yeah, I've got quite a very interesting but exciting story. As we were discussing earlier, I was born in the northern part of South Africa. It's a town in a township called Linyenye. It was quite an interesting childhood because from early on, I was exposed to very powerful women. So there was no point in my life. I thought I wouldn't do anything. So I grew up thinking I could be absolutely anything. And I wanted to become a doctor. However, I was also born in the apartheid era. Even though I knew that I could become anything, there was still a limitation within that anything. Because as in South Africa, at that point, as Black people, there were certain things that we could do and certain things that we couldn't do. So I wanted to become a doctor, and that's the path that I followed. I was accepted at university to study for a science degree, microbiology and biochemistry, in order to pursue my career of becoming a doctor. And it was during the 4 years of study that I took my first flight. And it was in that first flight that there was a female pilot, and I thought female could fly, because earlier on, when I was growing up in Limpopo, I've never seen anybody that looks like me. I've never seen women fly. And I was telling Vince earlier that the closest pilot that I've seen was Tom Cruise on TV, and he doesn't look anything like me. So, you know, obviously it was never a viable career choice for me. So it was in second year that it actually became a viable career choice, because I saw another woman flying. But as a Black woman, I still thought, no, maybe it's, you know, not really. You know, even though I started thinking about it, but not really. And it was only when I finished varsity that I joined an airline as cabin crew. And the reason why I joined an airline as cabin crew is I actually wanted to pay back my study loans so I can save money and proceed and go and do, you know, go on to do medical school.
So you were basically a flight attendant for a while.
Yes, I was. I spent about 3 years.
Just to learn more about the industry?
To learn, it was more to learn more about the industry. But the second thing as well, it was to make money so I can pay back, you know, my student loan to continue to medical school. But it was in that first week of training that I knew that medical school will not take place. I'm going to fly. I'm going to stay on, and I'm going to train to become a pilot. I'm going to fly. And there were a whole lot of factors that played a role. I enjoyed the job. I enjoyed the content. But it was so interesting that, you know, the pilots at that particular company kept on saying to me, you're so smart. You should be in front. You should be flying this aircraft. So, you know, sometimes we attribute our successes to only us as individuals, but I had a lot of people along the way who pushed me and who made me realize some of the potential that I possibly couldn't realize myself. So that was quite exciting. So I started taking private lessons, and my instructor was actually one of the captains at that airline. But unfortunately, I could afford only 1 hour a month because I needed to pay back my student loans. And with that salary, I could afford 1 hour. So I was actually, you know, earlier on, we're talking about it, that one of the interesting part, it took me about 4 to 5 hours to get to the nearest airport because I had to take 4 taxis and to be able to get to an airport. And it's normal. It's not the normal taxis that, you know, you're used to in New York where you hail a cab, you get in and it goes. No. It's a taxi where there's normally 15 people. So you get in, you wait for everyone else. So up until there's 15 people, that taxi doesn't move. Wow. So I would spend like 1 hour, 2 hours in the first taxi, wait for it to be full, get off the second taxi, wait for it to be full, and the fourth taxi, get to an airport and still walk a little bit of a distance before I can get to the actual flying school. By the time I get there, I'm tired.
You
so I was flying 1 hour.
You weren't going to let anything stop you, huh?
No, not at all. And I kept on doing that every month for that 1 hour. Took the 4 taxis to the airport so I can, you know, continue with my, you know, with the flight lesson. So yeah, that was.
How many months did you do that?
Oh no, more years. Not even years. Not even months.
Wow. So,
perseverance.
Yeah.
Serious so that perseverance.
Process, yeah, that process started in the early 2000, and I think got my first break in 2004. So a couple of years I kept on doing that. And I think it's quite interesting as well, because at some point I realized that I am not going to be able to complete my commercial pilot license, or it's going to take me 10 plus years. Because every time I go for a lesson, because I've only flown like for about an hour, the previous one, it's almost like you're starting from the beginning to sort of refresh your lesson and then go on to the next lesson. And then at some point, I wrote 200 letters to every company that I could think of. I told them who I am. This is what I'm doing. This is what I want to do. I want to fly. But most importantly, when I finish my license, I'll make sure that I help other youngsters that are facing similar challenges to, you know, to get to where, you know, so you were, need to be.
You were thinking about that even when you were going through it, about what you could do for the future. You hadn't even gotten where you wanted to be yet, but you were already thinking about the future.
Yes. So, and I was, I mean, I still have that letter. I articulate exactly this is what I'm going to do. Because initially, my initial challenge was I didn't know I could become a pilot. So that on its own, it's a challenge. The second one, I didn't have the finances. Two major challenges that are still even today facing, you know, the youth. So from that point, in that letter, I outlined exactly what I was going to do and the impact that I wanted to, you know, that I wanted to have. And three companies responded, and all of them, one of the reasons why they responded was because I said what I wanted to do in the future. But most importantly as well, I already had a science degree, which is a basic the basic foundation of the maths and the science. Already I met that criteria of being able to for my chances of success to actually increase. So three of them responded and they invited me to to go through their selection process. But this was the interesting part. I had
the whole thing is interesting. Your entire story. What do you mean this is the interesting part?
So no, go ahead.
it is interesting because I've never seen myself as a helicopter pilot. And not because I didn't want to become a helicopter pilot. I never thought it was an option as well. And I never knew about the careers that are, you know, involved in that particular sector within the helicopters. So when all of three responded, they all said, oh, we like your story, but we want to train you as a helicopter pilot. And I remember the first company, I'm like, I want to become an airline pilot. The second company as well, airline. And the third company, I'm like, no, there's something in here. I'm going to take this opportunity because I don't think there'll be any more opportunities coming through. So initially, I took that opportunity. I thought I will be trained as a helicopter pilot. I'll work 1 or 2, 2 years, then transition because it was going to be cheaper for me to transition to a fixed wing pilot and then join an airline. And that did not happen. I spent 10 years flying helicopters, the best job that I've ever done. The moment I got into that helicopter, I was hooked. And I knew that that is what I wanted to do. I loved the job. I loved flying the helicopters.
What was special about flying the helicopter, not only for you in terms of flying it as an aircraft, but flying it for the South African police?
I think it was more the work that we did. It was meaningful work. So you come back home every day, you know you've made a difference. You've either saved a life or you've removed, somebody was arrested, one of the criminals was removed, but there was always something when you came back. So it wasn't just going up there and coming down. You went out and you did the job. And I think for me, it was quite important. And it has all been, it has always been important in my entire life because the community that I was born at, the women that I was exposed to, they were doing something in their community. So when I was growing up, that was normal for me to be doing work that had an impact in the community. So the job as a helicopter pilot and the work that we did really combined my two passions, the passion of doing something within the community and, and really flying.
Sorry, but you bring up a really, really great point because you're sharing something that a lot of us don't know, that you grew up in a community where women were progressive and were doing things and were trying to do positive things for the community. And we don't always hear that story. We hear a lot of other things. So I just wanted to, because you have a story that we're going to enjoy throughout the show, but I wanted to stop down for just a second and ask you, as you were going through this, as you were studying and riding in taxis and then going in the training program and then flying helicopter, et cetera, and so forth, you had been facing a lot of obstacles. How did you handle that, mentally? How did you keep yourself motivated? Was part of it from the way you were, the community you were brought up in? Or how did you keep moving forward?
Vince, it was quite interesting that when I was going through that, I didn't really think there were obstacles. I thought this is part of what we do and what we go through, because again, I think you mentioned something very important, the upbringing. I was brought up by a single mother. She raised 7 kids. And in that particular community, the women were teachers leading. They were solving issues every day. We had a women doctor that had a garden, so everyone in that community made a plan in a way. So you grow up as if, okay, if something comes up, you make a plan.
You just deal with it.
you deal with it, you make a plan. And if, I mean, if I go back to even before I went to university, I didn't even have money to go to university. I had 200 Rand and it didn't worry me. 200 Rand, I was on my way to Cape Town and I started university. And I had to deal with it for 4 years where, you know, and I finished my degree. And at no point did I mean, I did everything at university. At no point was I stressed that there's this big problem that I couldn't pay, you know, my fees. Every year I would go, I would pay whatever I have. And if I didn't have enough, I'll go to the university. I'm like, I passed. You can't kick me out of the streets. I'm going to continue playing, you know, being here. I played sports. I was a captain of the football team. So those things as well helped.
Because, football as in soccer, right?
Yes, soccer, yeah, yeah.
Just want to make that clear for people that what the difference is over there. A lot of people don't realize that, that you know, you call that football over there. So, in fact, so everywhere helped, but in the U.S.
Yeah, no, it is, yeah, it is soccer. And I think those things helped because now the university knew you're doing all these things, you're participating in everything. So they didn't chase me out because I couldn't, you know, pay my fees. They left me for 4 years to finish, you know, to actually finish my degree. But just to answer your question, my upbringing was such that at that point, it was, okay, there's a problem, we solve it and we move on. Yes, I don't have money to go to flying, you know, the flying school. I'm going to write 200 letters. Somebody else, you know, out there has money to do it, you know, to pay for it, to help me pay for it. And that's exactly what I did. You know, so yes, my upbringing had a huge impact in how I dealt with every perceived challenge that I had, you know, yeah, that I had encountered.
Yeah. So we're going to save some of your story for a little bit later in the show. Part two, after the helicopter flying for the police, you got a whole nother segment to go with that. But I want to give Dr. Shea an opportunity, or Yolanda, she's asked me to call her, an opportunity to tell us a little bit about her path. And Yolanda, yours is also just as interesting because as a kid, you were actually, well, I'll let you tell the story, but you were actually interested in weather and meteorology and things like that. At a very early age, and then that transformed into where you are now. So tell us how you got started. What was the igniting factor for you getting into what you do now in terms of client assignments?
Thank you for Vince for the invitation. Rafilaway, I'm so excited to hear more of your story because I'm riveted here. It's a pleasure to be here with you. So I grew up here in the U.S. I was born up in Massachusetts. I lived there until I was about 9 years old, and then we moved down to Central Virginia. So it's further south in Massachusetts. I thought the thunderstorms in Virginia were a little bigger and scarier than the ones I remembered in Massachusetts, and this made me nervous for some reason. I was afraid of tornadoes. Tornadoes are not that common in Virginia. They can happen, but not sure what that fear was based on, but hey, I was a kid. Sometimes that happens. So, to make sure that we were safe, I would turn on the Weather Channel and keep it on for hours. I would sit there and watch it for hours. I just liked seeing, the meteorologists talk about how they put their forecast together. And then of course the reassurance that we were going to be okay also helped. But, the more I watched the Weather Channel, the more I realized that this was really fascinating. There's a lot going on behind the scenes. It felt like a puzzle how the meteorologists would use different information about different layers in the atmosphere, different variables, the moisture, the temperature, how the winds were moving, to put together their forecasts. So really from the age of, you know, 9 or 10, I was interested in being a meteorologist. I wanted to study the weather and put together forecasts. So all through middle and high school, that remained my interest. And I went to college to study atmospheric science. And in college, I learned several things. One, that I went to Cornell University up in upstate New York. They have a nice small atmospheric science program that appealed to me. I got to know all my professors. My professors knew me, at least in the atmospheric science department. And I got to know all my classmates. Again, nice small department, felt more like a family. And I learned, mainly from my classmates who were much more weather nerds, and I say that with the highest respect because I learned so much about forecasting from them. But they were much more weather nerds than I was. And I was realizing I like weather forecasting, but I'm not sure I like it enough to do it every day, day in, day out. So I began to look for opportunities to learn about other things that would interest me enough to pursue it as a career. So I did summer internships, worked with professors on different things, and realized that, one, I was interested in research. I liked and was intrigued by the idea that the professors didn't always have the answer. They were doing research too. And so we were kind of solving problems together, was learning how to pose research questions and figure out how to answer them. And that intrigued me. The other thing I learned that I was interested in, and I thought this was magical, that you can use remote sensing. So remote sensing is just a way of learning about something or sensing something without touching it. So you're doing it remotely.
Right.
So, you know, all of us on the call in one way or another, whether it's through closed captioning, maybe you're reading what we're saying, you're listening to what we're saying, maybe you're watching us. We're all using some remote sensing tools in our eyes and ears, right? Well, there are instruments that we design every day that also remotely sense our environment. And we can design them.
Which is amazing science, by the way.
Exactly. I thought it was magical.
Yeah.
So, of course, I ended up learning the science. So it's not quite so magical, but I still think it's incredible how much we can learn.
Well, it's with the technology, and the technology is you've grown with the technology. So you've seen it improve and improve. But go ahead.
Yeah, so that was something else that I learned through internships that I sought out in college, that I was interested in remote sensing. And specifically, I ended up realizing, well, I kind of learned this in grad school, I think. So I decided to go to graduate school after college to continue learning how to do research, to learn more about remote sensing and how we could use the radiation that Earth either reflects from the sun or emits based on, you know, its temperature and other properties. To learn about Earth. And I ended up studying more reflective sunlight based on the advisor that took me into his research group. And I did that at the University of Colorado at Boulder. That's where I got my PhD in atmospheric science. And that PhD is really learning how to do research. It's learning how to pose your own research questions and pursue them and answer them. While I was in graduate school in beautiful Boulder, Colorado, I was able to participate under the guidance of my research advisor on a project. So it was Clario, really the predecessor to Clario Pathfinder. But I got to work on Clario as a graduate student. Yes.
Oh, wow.
I had my own little project.
Before you joined NASA.
Exactly. It was my research advisor who had written a grant proposal and gotten funding. And that funding really supported my PhD education. And through working on that project and supporting this mission, I got to meet some of my colleagues who I still work with at NASA today. And it was really through that experience that I got to, well, let them know, I guess, just from, you know, doing my best and doing good work, that I could be a valuable asset to their team. So they saw that in me and decided, hey, you know, once a position opens up, we're going to let her know about it. And thankfully, I ended up getting that position. And that's the position I hold at NASA Langley in Virginia today.
Okay. So as I'm old school, so I'm going to say, hey, break it down for our viewers that aren't that familiar with the science of what you do. Tell us in lay terms what exactly you do in terms of this instrument that orbits the Earth, that I understand from the research I did is also going to be tied in or part of the International Space Station. Can you tell us a little bit more about it, again, in lay terms, what you guys are trying to learn?
Absolutely. So the Clario Pathfinder mission, which is a bit smaller, has a smaller scope than the full Clario mission did. That one didn't actually end up flying. We did quite a bit of science to lay the groundwork for Clario Pathfinder. But it will be, so it's not up there yet. It'll be launching hopefully in a couple years. But it will be an instrument mounted on this International Space Station that will be looking at Earth and taking measurements of reflected sunlight in a number of different frequencies between the visible, so the visible is the part of the spectrum where we, our eyes are sensitive, and then also some slightly longer wavelengths where we can't see information with our eyes, but we can still learn about clouds, about water vapor, about the surface from that reflected sunlight.
All the things that we're concerned about as a society.
Exactly, exactly. These are all things about Earth that it's important for us to have an understanding of. So that instrument will be unique in that it will be much more accurate than the instruments that we currently have observing Earth. And this is important for observing climate. So I want to talk for just a second about the difference between weather and climate. So weather, we all experience this, right? It's the day-to-day. Sometimes it's warm, sometimes it's cool. A couple days ago here in Virginia, it was in the mid-70s and it was gorgeous. Today, I think the high is in the 50s, so it's a little cooler and it's kind of rainy. So that's weather. You get those kinds of fluctuations.
Please explain that.
Well, that would take a much longer time.
No, go ahead.
But what I'll say is, you know, if someone were to ask me what it's like here in Virginia in the summer, I would say it's hot and sticky. It is hot and humid. That is the climate of Virginia. You know, that's a way of describing the climate in Virginia in the summer. Okay. But in the day-to-day in the summertime, sometimes it could be warmer, sometimes it could be cooler, sometimes it could be moist, sometimes it could be dry. That's the weather. With climate change, we could be getting, or we are seeing, that, for example, summers in Virginia could be getting warmer over time. So on average, you know, someone 50 years from now may say, it's hot and sticky, but it's hotter and stickier than it was 50 years ago, as an example. So to make sure we see those small but long-term changes in climate, we need to make sure we have high accurate and stable measurements that are kind of tied to solid standards so that we can discern those changes separate from any fluctuation. You know, instruments can be, they can be kind of finicky, right? And they're not perfect. How accurate they are can kind of drift. And so we want to be able to distinguish what fluctuations we're seeing in our instrument and how well it's taking measurements.
Data.
Exactly. And separate that out from what's happening physically in Earth's climate. So that's where the high accuracy tied to solid kind of anchored international standards comes from. And that's something that Clario Pathfinder will provide.
So one of the things that fascinates me about what you do and what you're involved in, and I like to point this out, is that there are a lot of partners and, you know, different organizations and companies, different parts of NASA, et cetera, that all come together to make this happen. Somebody has to put that Pathfinder in orbit. Somebody has to monitor it while it's in orbit. And, you know, there's your deep space network that's probably part of providing information for the data that you receive and the commands that you give to that spacecraft, et cetera, and so forth. But I looked on a page and it showed probably, 20 or 30 different agencies and companies and everything that's involved with this one project that you guys are doing.
Oh, yeah. So every satellite mission that both NASA and NOAA, who focus more on like weather satellites. Oops, I'm sorry. My screensaver came on. But
we didn't see it.
Oh, good. so I couldn't see you guys.
It's probably something climate related.
Yeah. we work on these satellite instruments. We work on them very hard here on the ground, and then we put them up in space and we can't touch them anymore, right? So there's all this work that needs to go into the quality of those instruments and making sure we understand them very well. Before they get launched into space, there's other things we can do to understand them after they're in space, but we have a lot less control over what we can wrap our heads around once they're up there. And that takes a lot of expertise, takes a lot of partners. On Clario Pathfinder, it's us at NASA Langley, and then our partners, actually, I'm still working with my research advisor and his group over at the University of Colorado. They're actually building the Clario Pathfinder payload, so the instrument and the pointing system and everything that will go onto the space station. And they work with a whole suite of companies that are providing them with the different components that will make up the payload.
Exactly.
So those are all those organizations. Mm-hmm. There are some here in the US, there's some in Europe. I mean, this really needs to be a collaborative, situation where we all put our heads together. We all bring different corners of expertise to this problem of building a lasting satellite instrument that can provide us with the kind of information that we need.
Well, and so like with Refill, I was going to try to roll my R. Don't leave it alone, Vince. Refill Way. I could listen to you for an entire show too. Both of you have just really, really amazing backgrounds with what you do. You know, one of the main goals with this program is to enlighten the up and coming and let them know about the opportunities that are out there, as well as inspire them to let them see what you representation, what you guys are doing, and hopefully also opening their eyes to let them know that there are a lot of things in addition to being a pilot, an astronaut, an engineer, et cetera, that are possibilities. As you do what you do for climate science and that type of thing at NASA, what are your thoughts about the next generation coming in and how to get them more engaged or let them know of the what's available out there?
So, something that Refill Way said about her experience that she didn't see anyone doing, being pilots, any women, or Black women being pilots, anyone who looked like her doing what she was interested in doing. And I can certainly still say that for myself, I get excited still just seeing people of color, especially women of color, who are in leadership positions who are leading missions or leading organizations at NASA. Because that helps me think like I could do this someday. I can only imagine what that looks like for a student who may look like me, who may be seeing me talk about what I do. And I hope that's inspiring to them. This is something that's important to me. I do this as a part of my job and trying to virtually talk to students in classrooms and different after-school programs and things like that, just to let them see, there's this representation in the field. And even if we're not dominating the field yet, we're here and we're doing great stuff. And that means that you can too. If I can do it, you definitely can.
Full disclosure. Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, that's it. Go ahead.
I was just going to say full disclosure. So my first time finding out about you and what you do and everything was when they did the dedication for the NASA headquarters renaming at the Dorothy Johnson NASA headquarters. And you
actually
were
Mary Jackson.
Mary Jackson. I'm sorry. I'm mixing up the hidden figures. Thank you for correcting me. But Mary Jackson headquarters. And you were one of the speakers for that, which the thing I looked at is I said, she's a what? so that got my attention, but it was really great to see that there was a woman of color in that aspect of the industry and that type of thing. I'm going to switch back over to you, Refill Way, as you patiently listened to a great background from Dr. Shea. But, you have a perspective that also is very interesting and very enlightening in terms of being from South Africa and being in a area that you have a lot of opportunity to expose people to the opportunities in aviation and aerospace. So when you tell us about your transition from being a helicopter pilot for the South African police to wanting to move forward with your foundation and the things that you're currently doing?
I think Yolanda as well has said it, I think, a few times as well, that you can't be what what you can't see. And earlier on as well, I said that I couldn't imagine myself being any of the things that I'm doing now because I didn't see people that looked like me. So I think that was one of the first biggest things. So it actually started during when I was still a helicopter pilot, that there's not a lot of us, you know, now that I've reached this stage, but I still don't see, you know, other people that, you know, that look like me. And I mean, the way as well, you know, few challenges within, you know, within the environment. I remember as well when, because they were not quite ready for us, we didn't have the uniform that actually fits us. So we had to wear male uniform, and I'm quite small. So you can imagine how big those overalls, flight suits were. So it was quite interesting. Yeah. So
you have tell that story, because that's an interesting story. A fellow pilot of yours here in the States told me about you and what you had to do to find something to fit you.
No, what is the story?
Well, that you actually found something here, right? On one of your visits?
Yes, one of the visits. So I was, it was quite interesting that
What did they say? Yeah.
No, because I was actually coming back to the story that at some point I was like, I need to interact with other women. I need to find out, you know, where do you get your uniform? What do you do? Women that have flown helicopters. Because it was quite interesting when I was doing training with the helicopter, I used to weigh like 40 something kg, and the solo requirement for helicopters are about 60, 65. So I had to fly with extra weight when I flew solo in the helicopters. So I used to walk around with like a bag or a concrete. So I wanted something much more sexy, if you can put it, that I can walk around, you know, like carry on and put it in my helicopter when I was flying solo. So I was like, I need to find other women. I need to speak to them. I need to find out.
Look more pilot-y.
Yeah, I know, right? So I needed, and there were not a lot of us. And I was like, so I was doing research. I found another women from Kenya who were interacting. And it was quite interesting that in that time, there was a conference that was taking place in Atlanta in the US, Women in Aviation Conference. I'm like, no, I have to go to this conference way back in 2009. And so I got my visa and I didn't know anybody. I just knew this lady, Kajuju from Kenya. And well, by just chatting on email, but we haven't actually met. And I flew to Atlanta to find other women. And I remember walking into that hall the first day, and it was just a wave of women. Women in the Navy, women from all over. And I was like, what? So there's
a great organization.
There is a lot of women for Women in Aviation International. And I think that's when it, you know, and this was quite actually, you know, important as well, because all along, even though I was in the industry for quite a while before I came, I went to the conference, I felt like a visitor. And it wasn't because of the people around me. I mean, I had a great boss, the people that I worked with, you know, they were great. But somehow I still felt that like I was a visitor in the, you know, in the industry, like I didn't quite belong. And it was in that conference, and I'm like, yo, I'm home. You know, there's all these people, they're wearing captain ranks, they're wearing, you know, and I've never, it, you know, from, you know, the few women that I've seen in South Africa, I had a, you know, my only view was only those few women that I've seen in South Africa. And then there's a whole lot of thousands of women. And I think it was in that moment that I felt at home in the industry that, you know what, I am part of, you know, I'm part of the, you know, in the industry. But what came about as well from that conference is the realization of the importance of going back and showing South Africa the same thing that I had seen. Because it was at that conference that I you know, finally was like, no, it was okay.
It was eye-opening.
It was eye-opening. And you know who I met at that conference? The first women that flew for the first black crew. It was Captain Rochelle and the first officer for in the US. Yes. They were at that conference. And I think it happened at that particular, like in 2009, around that particular time. And now I'm meeting that captain there. And I'm like, oh, okay, I saw you on TV. You know, great to meet you, so kind of thing. So it was a very impactful conference, very profound. It impacted my life, but most importantly, most of the decision, you know, coming from that conference and the people that I have met paved a way for what we have today, the foundation that I'm running, Girls Fly Program in Africa Foundation, because I came back home and I'm like, we need to have something similar to what I've seen in the US, so we can all gather, whether there's 10 of us or 15 of us, so these youngsters can see there's 15. So they are there. and we can have a platform where we can engage and we can, you know, in a way belong, you know, into that platform, because there's certain issues that are, you know, no offense to you, Vince, but they're just for us, you know, women. We need to sit there and we need to engage on
I
that
don't
level.
Take offense at all.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
tell
same
us about
as,
your foundation. Yeah. Tell us about your foundation.
So it was established to address challenges faced by, you know, by young students, particularly in the STEM field, but, you know, with a focus on, you know, on aviation and space. So one of the biggest thing growing up is I didn't have enough information. I didn't know I could become a pilot. So my foundation is solving that by being visible, by being accessible for those youngsters, that they too know that they could become pilot. Number two, provide them information. If you want to become a pilot, if you want to become an engineer or any career in the STEM field, what is then the process? Where do you get that information? So we wanted to provide that information. The third thing, scholarships, money. You know, most of the students that we impact, especially in South Africa and Africa, their story resonates with my story. Some of them are born in very poor background, poor families, and with that, they stand no chance, because to train as a commercial pilot in South Africa, it will set you about R500,000. So if you're, for example, from a family of seven and a single paycheck, there's no way that you're going to afford that R500,000. So we work with a different organization, different companies, to be able to provide them with scholarship, or even guide them. Where do you get the scholarship? Or even tell our stories. What is it that we did? You know, writing 200 letters, it might inspire somebody and say, you know what, I'll write 200 letters as well if I had to be faced with a similar challenge.
Exactly.
So that is why we exist. We want to impact life one girl at a time, through education, through mentorship, through scholarships, and networking. The other thing is networks. At that conference,
there you go. Yeah, I was going to actually talk to
yes.
both of you about that. So speak on.
Yeah, it's you know, those are very, very important, because that's how you get the next lead, the next job, the next opportunities. It happens through those networks.
Well, so you were an exact example of that when you came to the States and went to the Women in Aviation Conference. That was a big networking thing for you, because it introduced you to people that you would otherwise not have met.
It was a huge network. And guess what? The following year, we had a conference in South Africa. And guess who were at that conference? That network that I met in the US.
Nice.
I had women from the US Navy flying to South Africa for the conference. I had the networks flying to South Africa for the conference. But finally, I had people that I can go back to. And when there's a challenge and I'm like, you know, guys, I've got this challenge. How did you overcome the challenge? But even most importantly, during my career, my progression in the career, there was a point when I needed help with a scholarship. It was my networks, going back to those networks, applying for the 99 scholarships that enabled me to do my King Air rating, applying for Women in Corporate scholarship that enabled me to do my instructor's rating. Now creating those networks in South Africa, creating those platforms as well, for those youngsters to be able to access those opportunities that I was able to access through those networks that I made in that first conference, it was very, very important. And, you know, just before I can, like, you know, I'm not going to even mention the mission, but just in simple terms, that is why we exist, that we can have more of me and more of other those pilots in South Africa and in Africa as a whole.
Well, there you go. That says it all, but it gives me a good segue back to Yolanda. Yolanda, in your world of science and climate science, in terms of inspiring youth to get into this particular aspect of things, what kind of things do you recommend? What's their next steps to get involved in that? And what do they need from an education standpoint, et cetera?
Yeah. Math and science. That's always my first answer to this question. It can open so many doors. You hear it in Mathilde's story. You know, she had a science degree and, you know, her potential employers already liked that. They're like, oh, we don't have to worry about this. You already have this this understanding, this education. It provides you with a good foundation for you to ask whatever questions you may want to ask. You could dabble in one thing and then dabble in another thing if you want to. But it really does open doors if this is the kind of thing that's interesting to you. I think the persistence and the you know, the perseverance that we especially hear in Rafilway's story is important too. It's okay for this not to be easy. You know, if you struggle, if something is hard, it doesn't mean that you're not good at it. It doesn't mean that it's not possible for you. It just means that you may need a different approach. You may need some additional help. You know, just hearing all the information Rafilway talked about in terms of, you know, seeking out community, seeking out a network, you know, find your support network, whoever that looks like. If it's a group of friends who really truly believe that you are awesome and are, you know, willing to tell you that all the time, that can do a lot, you know, especially for those moments when it's harder and you're just not seeing it in yourself. And it doesn't just have to be people who look like you. I think I've had mentors. You know, one of the people who was responsible for my getting my job at NASA, you know, recently retired. And oh man, I swear he always saw the potential for me to lead this team, to be a leader on this project. And I didn't see it every day. And it was helpful to know that someone who had such a big influence in climate science had that confidence in me, my research advisor, and of course my family and friends. I have a core group of women who we were all in graduate school together. So we all got degrees in PhDs in atmospheric science, and we're still on, you know, text chain, and we still encourage each other, even in our jobs now.
That plays a big part of it too. Your colleagues and that type of thing. You know, so Rafilway and Yolanda, you guys are one of many who have, and many that I've had on the show, and both of you have talked about it today in terms of your backgrounds, who have taken paths that you didn't even realize you were gonna take. And I think that's a big takeaway, that you can start out with one goal and you may have a bigger goal, a long-term goal, but to get to that other end, you may go through a lot of different iterations and changes and challenges, et cetera, and so forth. But in terms of persistence, sticking with your main goal, you know, will help you get there, even if you have to zigzag on the way.
And it's okay for that goal to change. You know, I mean, I started off thinking I was going to be a meteorologist, and that is not that's okay that it wasn't in the cards for me, or that wasn't the right path for me. But I worked hard to figure out what did kind of speak to me and where I could make my mark. And also, I think it's helpful to tell students that it's okay if you don't know exactly what you want. If you just have something that interests you, go pursue it. You know, go play in that for a little bit. And it may open doors for you that, and also figure out what doors you should close and say, you know, like Rafilway saying, like, I'm not going to be a doctor. I'm going to go over here. And then that opened doors that she probably didn't imagine even the first day that she realized that she wanted to go into aviation. Rafael, I don't know if you want to talk more about that, but.
No, what I was going to say is that one of the biggest joys I've had is seeing somebody that was inspired by what I do in the industry and watching them climb and grow and do there. Have you guys experienced that, where you've had a student or somebody that you've known that got inspired by what you were doing and therefore now they're doing something great too? Either one of you.
Yeah. I think with the Girls Fly program in Africa, you know, just going back, when you've got a volunteer-based organization as well, you need an inspiration to keep going. And we continuously get messages of, oh, thank you, this is where I am. Or I just graduated in an aeronautical engineering degree. Or I went solo, you know, for my flying. So it is quite like, we get that every day, and it keeps us going, because when you hear those positive stories, how your story has impacted somebody else, or how somebody started because, you know, of hearing what you've done, you just keep going. And I mean, we've been at it for the past 10 years in different forms, and you know, the gains that we get is those stories, the feedback that we're getting. But I just wanted to add what Yolanda has said earlier on, the importance of being open-minded enough to pivot as well. Because sometimes, you know, you get challenges, and sometimes opportunities, they mask themselves as challenges as well. Where if you're not open-minded enough and say, okay, let me try this, maybe let me go this path, you'll never know
Like you did as a helicopter pilot.
As a helicopter, and you know, as and as well saying, you know, you've got, yes, I had a plan. You want to become a doctor, but maybe not. You know, having that flexibility, or I wanted to become a meteorologist, maybe not. Maybe having that open-minded enough and flexibility enough, and say, let me try something else. You know, there's still that plan that's in place, but perhaps that's something else that is your, you know, that is your path. So I think, just to add on what you said earlier, that for me, it's quite important that when a challenge comes, embrace it. I know sometimes it's you know, for the youngsters, it's difficult. And I can assure them, every success that I've had, it was masked as a challenge.
Sure. Yolanda, how about you? What's your perspective on that in terms of what you've seen?
I love that, that every opportunity you've had has been masked as a challenge, because I certainly have had things that have terrified me that I have tried or done, and whether they end up being successful or not, I learned something from them. And I think having that growth mindset of, I'm going to try this thing and see how it goes, and okay, if it's not a screaming success, that's okay. But what do I learn from that? What do I take with me to the next opportunity or challenge that I pursue? And I agree, Rip Feelway, that like, it's encouraging to hear from students like, hey, you inspired me, or hey, this experience that we had together was so exciting. I want to continue working in this, or I want to go off and pursue something different, but like, still that their interaction with you or your story or something inspired them, or that they took your advice and that it's working well for them. That's, it certainly, you know, adds to the excitement of wanting to do, even opportunities like this of, you know, this, you know, who knows what we've said in this 1 hour that could inspire someone or
absolutely
help encourage someone, you know? So, yeah,
absolutely. That's why I do the show every week.
I love that.
You were going to say something earlier, Yolanda, sorry, about regarding aviation or aerospace. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, you had mentioned this about NASA when we were talking before the show, that NASA is often thought of as an organization that studies planetary bodies and other planets, because Earth is a planet. So we do study planetary bodies. But then also, you know, NASA does aviation at NASA Langley. That, you know, NASA Langley is over 100 years old, and it has its roots in aerospace and aeronautics research. So, you know, there, if someone's interested in working at an organization like NASA, you know, there's so many different things you can do. Even if you're not interested in a STEM field specifically, we have people who are experienced in science writing or the journalism side to help us tell our story. Sometimes we scientists and engineers need help with that. We have folks who help manage our finances. We have lawyers. I mean, there are different ways you could support technical missions if you're just excited about the story that we have to tell.
No, that's a great thing that you bring up. Try to tell people that all the time. You can have an area of specialization that you may not think is applicable to aviation or aerospace, and in fact, it very much is. Mm-hmm. I remember somebody recently finding out that's interested in being an attorney and found out that they're aviation lawyers, you know, so there's aviation law. And they were like, oh, really? There's aviation law? Yeah. Somebody's got to take care of those things too. So I had a funny one. It was the professor, Pablo De Leon at UND, University of North Dakota. And I'll never forget the comment he made while he was doing the show with us. And he said, yeah, well, you know, when we go to Mars, we're going to need a few things, like somebody's going to have to have a dental background in case any of us have problems with our teeth and things like that. And I was like, you know, you got a point there, guy. So absolutely. Listen, we only have about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to make sure that I give you both an opportunity to talk a little bit about what you see in the future, because we are in a robust industry, both aviation and aerospace. I mean, there's the infamous pilot shortage, which kind of came to a stop in 2020, but got news for everybody. It's going to be back with a vengeance, and there's going to be a lot of opportunity to be a pilot, to be, you know, in all the other areas of it, a mechanic, et cetera, and so forth. And of course, we can all see what's going on in aerospace with the landing of Perseverance on Mars and the Ingenuity helicopter that's supposed to fly next week. First time on something built here on Earth flying on another planet or another planet's atmosphere and all that kind of stuff. So, and not to mention the Artemis program that's going to go to the moon and to Mars. So there's just tons of things going on. I'll start with you, Rafil. What do you see with what you're doing and what you would like to see happen with young girls there in South Africa and in Africa as a whole? And quite frankly, you have an international influence. So, but what would you like to see and what do you see in the future?
Yeah, it's, you know, when we look at STEM education as a whole, statistics, 75% of the future jobs are gonna require STEM. You mentioned the fact that yes, there's a downturn in the aviation industry, but we know we've faced downturns in previously, but we've always managed to come up again. So the demand for pilots is going to increase. Less than 5% of airline pilots still are women. So women pilots are still gonna be in demand. But I think most importantly as well, we're gonna start seeing some of the other technologies, like for example, drone technology, you know, picking up, and especially in our continent, Africa, where, you know, where we still have issues of infrastructure, we still have issues of transporting certain things. So I see that technology picking up, you know, quite a lot to actually solve some of the socioeconomic challenges that we're facing as a continent. So in terms of where the foundation is going, we're going to keep at it. We're going to keep encouraging girls to enter the careers in the STEM field, because that's where everything is going. If 75% of the jobs are going to be in the STEM field, we better be on the forefront. Majority of that 75%, it better be us. So we're preparing them. Yeah, we're preparing them. But I mean, from even an economic perspective, you know, to solve some of the socioeconomic issues in the continent as well, you need to make sure that the majority of that population is educated in the technical field. So sure. I see the drone technology picking up, and yeah.
Yeah, no, I was going to go ahead because I was going to ask you to mention we only have a few minutes, but go ahead and say what you're going to say about drones.
Drones technology. So I'm currently involved in, you know, besides the manned aviation, I'm currently involved in the unmanned aviation industry as well, in the training side, where we have specialized courses in the drone industry. So we don't only teach about the technology, but we teach about the application in some of the pertinent industry in Africa. We look at food shortage, which is directly linked to agriculture. So how do we, you know, start increasing the production?
How do you use that
you use that technology to do that? Because whether we like it or not, as Africa, we have to leapfrog. We can't be saying, let's solve this and whatever. If we had to start using that technology, we need to start using that technology today. So I'm involved in that. It's quite exciting. And we're getting as many women in the industry, in that industry as possible, involved in the agriculture, because not only does it give them the skill to be able to apply that technology, now as people that are in that agriculture field, they're suddenly increasing their production, they're using that technology. So we're changing the landscape, we're changing the, you know, the field. So for us, I think for me, it's one of the exciting things that, I'm currently involved in.
Wonderful. And Yolanda, our climate is evolving on an ongoing basis and in a very significant way. So what do you see for the future with regard to what you do and what the upcoming generation can get involved in?
What I've been inspired by the younger generations, you know, teenagers and the 20 somethings, that they see the impact that climate change is having on our earth, on our home, and are not standing for it. You know, they're throwing out lawsuits and they're thinking of ways that we can better take care of earth. We're going to need solutions like that. We're going to need that kind of radical thinking. I'm excited that they are thinking about that and they are working toward that. You know, once they're ready to vote and once they're ready to, you know, get into the workforce, I can only imagine what they're going to do. But, you know, this is a problem that's going to stick with us. We have 7+ billion people on this earth and we continue to live here. And we're going to need some creative problem solving to help us figure out how we can best take care of our earth as we do that. And then we're also going to need more scientists to understand how our behavior is impacting the climate. You know, this is a nonpartisan issue. This is something that we all need to rally around as a global community to best understand. So, you know, the more diverse thought that we can get involved in the field, the better.
Ladies, I could have had a show for each of you, 1 hour each, about all the things that you have to say about what you do, who you are, and where you've come from in terms of your careers. It has been an honor and a pleasure having both of you on this show and talking about very enlightening and valuable information for our viewers, for the young ones, for some of the parents watching, and for some in the industry who I know are watching too. So thank you again, Dr. Yolanda Shea at NASA, Langley Research Center. Appreciate you being with us.
Thank you so much.
Refilwe.
Oh, yes. Madwaba. Yeah. You roll the tongue nicely now.
That's beautiful.
I had to give it a go at least one time. No, seriously, all the way from Johannesburg, which right now, I believe it is 6 p.m. there.
Yes, it is 6 p.m. indeed. 1800.
Yes. Thank you so much for being on with us. You have an extremely busy schedule as well. So for both of you to take the time out to be on the show is greatly appreciated, ladies.
Thank you for having us. And Yolanda, it is a pleasure meeting you. I shall be visiting you in the US at some point.
It's a pleasure meeting you. If I ever find myself in South Africa, I'll try to look you up.
Awesome. Well,
so ladies, wishing you both the best, and particularly with what you're both doing in your careers and everything, seriously hope that things continue to move forward as they keep on keeping on, is a better way for me to put it. But thank you again. My name's Vince Mickens, and this is All Things Aviation and Aerospace. I'm with Private Air Media Group. And it's been great to have everybody watching and got a lot of questions. Sorry I didn't get all your questions in, but thank you all for watching the program. We'll see you next week with another show. You guys take care. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening to this live stream weekly webcast that has been repurposed as a podcast for your convenience. All Things Aviation and Aerospace is designed to open the eyes of aspiring young aviation and aerospace professionals about the possibilities, your options, and the opportunities in a thriving and growing industry. Each week, I feature seasoned aviation and aerospace professionals to talk with them about their career paths, hear their stories, and gain insight on how they figured things out and hung in there until they could see the fruits of their efforts. And most importantly to you, hearing their advice about what works and what doesn't. All Things Aviation and Aerospace is a digital media production of the Private Air Media Group, hosted by me, Vince Mickens. So if you like what you hear, please subscribe to whichever podcast directory you use most frequently. Thanks again for listening to All Things Aviation and Aerospace. Stay healthy, stay safe, blue skies.